Tonight on Arena, author Laura Lippman on her novel Prom Mum, and we have fiddle player Natalie McMaster and family playing live in studio. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. But we start this evening with the award-winning film director William Friedkin, who has died at the age of 87. His work, particularly in the 1970s, was genre-defining, but in his case, two very different genres. With The French Connection, he showed what crime drama could do, leaning into his career origins in documentary to create a gritty authenticity entirely new to cinema. It won 5 Oscars, including Best Director, Best Film and Best Actor for Gene Hackman. And with The Exorcist, his 1973 follow-up, he made a truly modern box office horror smash, although he later said that for him, it was a film about faith. The French Connection and The Exorcist and their long, though successful shadows, perhaps detracted from his later work. He was known for bombastic antics on set and controversial approach to working with actors. Joining me to remember the work of William Friedkin is Paul Whittington. A very interesting start for him, Paul, in that he started in television, but he started in the post room in television.
He started in the mail room.
He really did work his way up right from the very bottom through to making his own dramas and onwards from that.
He did. He was born in Chicago, Sean. He was the son of Ukrainian Jewish immigrants, and he didn't do that well in school, and he was wildly ambitious but not all that focused. And then he got this job in the mail room, and he worked his way onto the studio floor, and he began floor managing stuff and eventually directing live dramas. And then he got into documentary and film. And the thing that really inspired him to take cinema seriously was watching Citizen Kane 5 times in a row in a flea pit in Chicago in the early 90s. That'd do it, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he said that his life really changed from that moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
But given that he did start in documentary making before he went into to drama, and I suppose I'm thinking particularly here of The French Connection, you would have to say that the film all about the drug business, I suppose, it has a kind of a documentary feel to it, or certainly in its story at any rate.
Absolutely, Sean, the way it's made, he made it like a documentary. Handheld was not that usual at the time. The French New Wave, Godard and Truffaut had started doing it. He did that. There was a total veracity to what he did. In movies up to that point, there was a kind of gloss to storytelling. That was all gone. This was the proper New York of the 1970s. It was gritty. It was ugly. And that film really conveyed that very, very powerfully.
And he didn't want Gene Hackman the leading role.
He was absolutely adamant that he was not going to have Gene
Hackman. And how did that change, or what happened?
It changed because the studio demanded it. I mean, he wanted Paul Newman, he wanted Steve McQueen. The budget, this was not going to be a big film. The budget did not dictate that. And Gene Hackman was less well known at that time, and they did not get on. In fact, Friedkin subsequently said that when Hackman was railing against, you know, Charnier, the drug dealer, it was actually him he was railing against. They really didn't get on. But that contributed to this sort of snarky energy in the film, I think. And obviously the most famous. I watch that film regularly, often, and it's one of those films that really stands up and that you find new things in each time. And obviously the car chase is the most famous.
Yeah, and I suppose those shots with the car going under the L, isn't it? The elevated railway.
Yeah, and they slowed the real rate to make the impression of speed faster, and there were accidental collisions because the stuntmen couldn't avoid the car, and it's an extraordinary piece of cinema.
And despite the rows that went on between Hackman and Friedkin, or possibly because of the rows that went on between the two of them, they both won Oscars.
Yeah, they did. Hackman's character was based on this guy called Eddie Egan, who was on the set at the time, actually, and his performance is just brilliant and just has this kind of veracity to it. And they did. I notice in all the Oscar pictures, they're not standing beside each other, but they did both win them. And, of course, Friedkin then went on almost immediately afterwards to make an even more famous film.
Yeah, well, we'll come to The Exorcist in a minute, but let's hold off on it for just a moment, because I want to listen to Hackman in the French connection as the character Jimmy Doyle, based on the real life character that you were saying, and he's roughing up a suspect here in an alleyway. He wasn't given to traditional police methods. He wasn't one for keeping the rules. A little bit of language for sure towards the end of this clip.
I want to talk to you. You ever been to Poughkeepsie? Huh? Have you ever been to Poughkeepsie?
Hey man, come on, give me a break. Hey, what are you talking about?
Let me hear you say it. Come on. Have you ever been to Poughkeepsie? You've been to Poughkeepsie, haven't you?
I want to hear it!
Come on!
Yes, I've...
You've been there, right?
Yeah.
You sat on the edge of the bed, didn't you? You took off your shoes, put your finger between your toes and picked your feet, didn't you? Now say it!
Yes!
All right. You want to see him, my partner. You know what that means? God damn it! All winter long, I got to listen to him gripe about his bowling scores. Now, I'm going to bust your ass for those three bags, and I'm going to nail you for picking your feet in Poughkeepsie.
There you go. You wouldn't want to be asked by Gene Hackman, have you ever been to Poughkeepsie, would you?
No, you wouldn't, no. And that was apparently a real ploy that the real detective, Roy Scheider, who was great in it as well, played his partner, and he would be very unreasonable and the partner would be less unreasonable. It was the old good cop, bad cop.
I suppose this is part of the authenticity that was all part of that documentary making style. When it comes to the Exorcist then, which you say it followed up practically immediately.
2 years later.
Two years later on. Mm. And he had done so well with the French Connection. Obviously, he had been a big hit. We said the three various Oscars that it got. When it came to the Exorcist, are we in a kind of a documentary world, albeit a supernatural world, but a kind of a documentary world?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's what's interesting about the films, that he didn't set out to make a horror film. Horror was really, I mean, Rosemary's Baby, this is compared to, I think this is better than Rosemary's Baby. Horror films was kind of a joke in the early 70s, and he simply by making it real, by filming it in that sort of close documentary way, and by taking as read the fact that this was not a joke, that there was a demon in this teenage girl, it made it terrifying, especially if you were raised Catholic, of course.
Yeah, it was very much. He said this himself, as I said in the introduction, he said himself frequently afterwards that it wasn't a film, it wasn't a kind of this supernatural horror film, it was a film about faith.
Yeah, absolutely. And the priests, not just Max von Sydow's priest, but the other priest who meets an unfortunate end, are really almost the stars of it, as well as
Linda Blair
and Ellen Burstyn. And
Ellen Burstyn was the mother, wasn't she?
Yeah,
the mother
she was.
Of the Linda Blair character.
And their belief is threatened and they must live through that. So I can see what he meant by it. But I didn't see it for years, actually. I didn't see it until, you know, many years after it's released. And I couldn't believe how little happened in it, but how much it made you imagine.
Well, I'm going to give you 43 seconds of a lot of happening. In fact, it's the famous exorcism.
Bed levitations.
Yeah, famous exorcism scene. And obviously within this scene, there's language, there's blasphomy, there's all sorts of things going on.
There is. Oh, the stuff we can't mention.
But let's have a listen. But be warned, this is not for the faint-hearted. The exorcism scene from The Exorcist, Max von Sydow, Linda Blair is the several voices that you will hear screaming obscenities in the background. And he is trying to get rid of this demon from within the teenage girl.
I cast you out, unclean spirit!
Show it up your ass!
In the name of our Lord Jesus Christ! It is he who commands you! He who flung you from the heights of heaven to the depths of hell!
Fuck him!
Be gone!
Fuck him, Garrus!
From
Fuck
this
him.
Creature of God! Be gone! In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and the Holy Spirit, by this sign of the Holy Cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, who lives and reigns with the Father and the Holy Spirit. Damien!
You know, listening to that in
1973.
Now listening to that in 2023, it's still shocking in the way it treats faith and the way it, you know, the cursing that is going on within that. Put that into some kind of context in 1973. 50 years ago was when those words were first heard.
Yeah.
Like, I remembered at the time that people just, you were not allowed, you were not allowed to be looking at that.
No, and I believe it was banned here, I think it was, because for a couple of very specific reasons it was banned here. But I think that The thing about The Exorcist was that there's always almost always a spoof element to horror. There was no spoof element to The Exorcist. It was all very serious. And if you hear that in isolation, you think that's a bit of a laugh. But if you go through the whole film to get to that point, it's not funny at all. People queued around the block to watch this film. Imagine that. It was a pop cultural phenomenon. There were faintings. There were episodes. There was this whole story about the film having been cursed because of its subject matter, people dying and all this sort of stuff. It had a huge moment, after which it was going to be very difficult for Friedkin to match anything.
And
like
you know,
again,
when you think of some of the, in inverted commas, reality programs now that we get about hauntings and exorcisms and spirits being in people and all that type of thing, this really was the father of the father and mother of all of those
absolutely
films and those reality programs, which kind of are soft sell in comparison to that.
Yeah, absolutely, and it was all from his way of orchestrating it. And I mean, films like The Omen do seem very funny in comparison. That came out a few years later. He said he never saw anything that happened subsequent to The Exorcist in terms of other films, and that, and I believe him that he didn't. But
this
was just
Friedkin,
it was just really masterfully put together. It's a brilliant piece of cinema.
And then add into all of that, because when I was listening to the news over the weekend and I heard about his death, and you go, oh yeah, The Exorcist, The French Connection. After that, you kind of go, what else was there?
Well, I think he was, in some senses, although he was very irritated when people said it, he was a victim of those films' success. He wasn't that young when he made them. He was in his mid-30s, but he did make very good films subsequent.
What would stand out for you? And again, I mean, some of these names, I think, will, if not be totally new to people, they certainly won't be very familiar.
Well, he made a film in 1977 called Sorcerer, which had the great misfortune to come out a couple of weeks after Star Wars, which kind of obliterated everything. And it was not a remake of The Wages of Fear, which is a great Henri Georges Clouzot thriller about Yves Montand, these guys going across Paris in a van full of explosives that won't stop. But it seemed like one, and it was sort of piled on because of that. He made a film called Cruising in 1980. Which was set in the gay subculture of New York. Al Pacino was in it, and it sort of fell foul of a number of things, and it wasn't great, but there were some good bits in it. To Live and Die in L.A. people think very, very highly of, which was a mid-80s film. I think it was very good. Some people say it was the best thing he did. I don't think it was the best thing he did, but he did make a very good film in 2011 with Matthew McConaughey.
Part of the reconnaissance, really, wasn't it? It kind of started that off.
That began that, Killer Joe. That was a very decent film. And in fact, he was still working at the... He has a film that will be shown, premiered in Venice next month.
Yeah, premiered in Venice next month. The Canine Mutiny Court Martial, which has the smell of a documentary story off it as well.
You remember there was a film called The Canine Mutiny, a Humphrey Bogart film in the 50s. I think it's kind of a sort of retake on that.
Okay. Well, that is the life and career of William Friedkin there. Paul Whittington with us in studio this evening. And Friedkin's death was announced this weekend. He was 87. The winner of virtually every American prize available to authors of crime fiction, Laura Lippman, established her formidable reputation with a series of novels about the accidental PI, Tess Monaghan, while she was still a reporter with the Baltimore Sun newspaper. Laura's 25th novel, Prom Mom, is a standalone title. It moves between the 1990s, when Baltimore High School student Amber Glass is accused of killing her baby, and 2019, when the death of her stepfather brings her back from New Orleans to her hometown. Delighted to be joined on the programme this evening by Laura Lippman. As I said, Laura, the novel opens in 1997 with this teenage character, Amber Glass, waking up after a prom night to a horrendous, it has to be said, morning after. There was a real life story that inspired this, or maybe a number of real life stories that inspired this particular aspect of the novel?
Yes, this is something that actually happens. It might not happen proximate to a school dance, although there are at least two cases like that in the 90s. But this is something that's always happened in the United States and continues to happen and will probably be happening more as they restrict abortion laws. So it wasn't so much the particular case as it was listening to a podcast about the particular case in which the host, Sarah Marshall, made this kind of offhand comment like, oh yes, and teenage girls know their bodies so well. And for some reason, in the moment that I heard that, I had this really profound, empathetic moment of, oh, that's right. Mm. It is actually totally plausible that a teenage girl could be in a situation like this and just be in complete denial about it and really sort of practicing this kind of magical thinking. And so I got to thinking about that, and I got to thinking about how in this world we live in now, where you can Google just about anyone at any time, who gets a second chance? Who gets to start over? Who gets to put the mistakes of their youth behind them?
And in fact, am I right in thinking that the title of that podcast was in fact Prom Mom, and you took it directly as the title for the novel as well?
I straight up stole it, but I was very direct. I wrote to Sarah Marshall, whom I didn't really know at the time, and said, hey, I love your podcast. I'm going to be stealing this title. And in just a kind of unforeseen twist, Sarah and I became friends during the pandemic. She would talk to me while I walked. I take these very, very long walks. She lives in Portland, Oregon, which is 3 hours behind Baltimore time. And so we got to know each other quite well. But at the time I heard the podcast, she was just someone I admired and whose work I thought was really terrific.
And so did you agree a walk time that suits both time zones?
Yes. Yes. It was tricky. She couldn't do it at my normal 6 a.m. walking time.
I'm sure she couldn't.
Afternoons.
Yeah. Susie, because she'd have been fast asleep. Anyway, let us move off walking times and go back to that, because I think it's a very interesting thing you touch on there, Laura, this idea of the teenage pregnancy. And I think you referred to magical thinking, which might cause this kind of denial. Obviously, in this country, teenage pregnancies and difficulties in and around it, particularly in the mid to late part of the 20th century, were the subject of major problems in this particular neck of the woods. But when you talk about magical thinking and denial, are you saying that these teenagers may not have been physically aware of what was happening in their body, or that there was just this psychological denial about what was going on?
I think it's both. I think they absolutely shout it down. And, you know, it's not so straightforward being an adolescent girl. And when you see how laws are being made in the United States right now, you realize that there are a lot of men in political positions who actually know nothing about the female body. And so it isn't that odd to not know you're pregnant. I just was in St. Louis on my book tour, and I ran into a friend who is both a writer but also a retired emergency room nurse. And she said, oh, we saw 10 of those a month, and it wasn't just teenagers. She told me the story of a 40-year-old woman coming into the ER and having no idea she was pregnant.
Wow. So and it's not something that happened in 1970 or 1980 or even in this case 1990. This is something that is happening today.
Oh yes, it's going to get worse. I mean, I just can't see how with some of the legal changes and statutory changes that we're seeing state to state in the United States, it's almost, some lawmakers are begging this to happen. I didn't set out to write a political book. When I was writing this book, I'm not a prescient person. I did not see that. I didn't see Roe v. Wade being overturned until the memo came out. The memo was leaked by Justice Alito. And I was like, oh my God, it's really going to happen. I tend to be a little too Pollyanna-ish. And I really had a hard time wrapping my head around the fact that this very profound right that was earned during my lifetime was also going to be taken away during my lifetime. You don't see that so often.
And at what point were you at in the writing of Prom Mom when that overturning of Roe v. Wade took place?
I think I had finished. I had finished. It was definitely in edits. I think I have that right. I get confused about time, but it was pretty much done. And it actually even took a while for me. You know, your book becomes so personal and so private. And I was just writing about these three people, you know, the girl who got pregnant, the boy who took her to the prom, who they were as adults. And the complicating factor of his wife, to whom he's very happily married. So I wasn't thinking about it in political terms. It didn't come to me as a political idea, but, you know, it has inevitably been politicized by recent events.
Yeah, and that was unintentional, you're saying, on your part. There was another true life tale, which I think tickled your fancy, if that's not too crude a term, but certainly piqued your interest. Let me say that instead. It piqued your interest about a couple, not unlike the Amber and Joe of your story, who had the prom baby type of experience, different from in your novel, and then met each other again later into their adult lives.
Yes, on Facebook. I think that was the part that really caught my attention. I don't have the right word for it. It was just sort of like, okay, this is the world we live in now, where two people who were once involved in a fairly infamous crime just meet each other on Facebook a couple of decades later and become friends.
It is kind of quite extraordinary. The reporter in you must have thought, if that reporter instinct is still alive and well, must have thought, this would be a great story to tell in an article.
I mean, I was really fascinated. I'm fascinated by social media in general. I've kind of whittled down my own daily diet. So I'm on the platform that I still call Twitter. I don't call it by its new name. And that's about it for me. And yet I still think it's so interesting. I've met lots of friends on it. I mean, it has all of these powers for good and all of these powers for bad. But I think as a reporter, what really interests me is, again, this is something I lived through. Once upon a time, your mistakes weren't that easy to find. As a young reporter in Waco, Texas in the 1980s, I made some really big boneheaded mistakes, because you do as a young reporter. But it's not easy to search my name and find the clarifications and corrections that had to be issued on a couple of the stories I wrote in my 20s. And I sort of saw this happening around the time I left newspapers, which is, you know, at the beginning of this century, over 20 years ago. And I remember trying to write an article telling people to maybe rethink some of these confessional pieces they were writing, because it was all going to be so accessible now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy, the information about us that is at everybody's fingertips. You know, how do you disappear if that's what you want?
I'm wondering then, what kind of effect does that have when it comes to the writing of novels? Okay, they mightn't be able to search on the internet and find your novel, but all of your novels will exist in print. What kind of responsibility does that put on you, particularly in a novel like this, Prom Mom, where, as you've admitted, it became a very political statement, yes, because of the events that happened in and around Roe v. Wade and the overturning of that ruling. But what kind of responsibility does that put on the novelist? You know, it's down there in black and white and it's readily achievable. It's probably on Audible and it's probably available in an online version anyway.
Well, I think that's a great question, and it's a big question. I'm not sure I can get to all the pieces of it, but I will say that as someone who's been publishing since 1997, I do think about whether books I wrote earlier would offend current sensibilities. And if people want to describe that in a disparaging way as woke, so be it. The mere fact is, there are terms that we used in the 1990s, in the aughts, that are now considered offensive. I mean, you can see this really easily. There are certain racial terms that appeared in books that are now quite offensive. And so I'm sort of interested in that in general. And I actually have an intern. There's a woman in my neighborhood who needed credit for her creative writing degree. And she asked me if she could work for me. And I was like, I can't pay you, but you can be my intern. And she's actually going through my first 10 to 12 years of writing and just making notes. She's annotating it. And then we're going to sit down and think about whether any of this language is harmful or insensitive. Mm. And if it is, what do we want to do about it? So right now I have all the questions about what you're asking. I don't readily have the answers. It's kind of new. Mm. People aren't used to staying in print forever. And I happen to be in the middle of listening to a fantastic podcast about the writer Laura Ingalls Wilder, who's one of the most popular writers who ever lived, but who, you know, not that long ago, a prize that was named after her took her name off the prize because her writing about Native Americans is incredibly problematic. And like I said, I don't have all the answers for this. I just know that they're the right questions to be talking about and asking now.
And I guess that's what you will say to me. You don't have the answer, but it is a good question around, you know, there was much talk recently about the re-editing of Roald Dahl's writing because some of the terms within those children's books were potentially offensive. What was your feeling around that?
Well, that was fascinating to me because that was done at the directive, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, that's done at the initiative of a company. That's like just pure capitalism. It's like, oh, this might offend people. Let's change it. I don't remember there being any outcry at a grassroots level about the doll books. Mm. Some of the language is troubling. Some of it is a little bit. I prefer, I think, more contextual readings. But they're really interesting arguments about that, too, especially when you're talking about books read by children. Again, there are no really easy right answers. It goes too far sometimes, definitely.
Yeah.
But it's still good to be thinking about it. Anyone by thinking about it.
Yeah. And let me ask you one final question there. And in terms of terminology around prom mom, I'm interested in prom mom was the name given to Amber Glass. Cad Dad was the name given to Joe Simpson, who is her teenage lover and who's still a bit of a cad dad when we meet him in the 2019 part of the novel. How joyous was it for you to use those two phrases, and do they have particular potency for you?
I mean, it was fun because that's the one I got to make up. That's the headline that didn't exist around any of these cases. So, I mean, I really liked writing the character of Joe. And I was very much influenced by an essay by the writer Mary Gordon called Good Boys and Dead Girls. And in it, she examined this really interesting through line in mid-20th century American literature in which good men, good in quotes, but men who see themselves as good, achieve liberation and freedom through the death of a female. Mm-hmm. And she looked at Dreiser, American Tragedy. She looked at Faulkner. I never remember the Faulkner title. It's the one with Joe Christmas. And then she looked at the Rabbit books by John Updike. And this is a fascinating essay. It's like it's something everyone should be reading now because it asks all those questions about problematic writers and problematic themes. The same things that Claire Detter did so brilliantly in this recent book called Monster, which is how we deal with art by problematic people. And so I loved writing Joe. I considered it, it sounds bold. It's a little hubristic, but it was like, here's my homage to those Updike books, which I love so much. And I just loved writing the character of Joe because it was like the days I was writing Joe's parts were the days I got to try on what absolute privilege and entitlement feels like.
Yeah. Yeah,
like, what if you're never to blame for anything and everything just always goes your way?
Well, thank you so much for being a totally unproblematic interviewee and a very interesting one at that. Lovely to have spoken with you this evening, Laura.
Thank you so much. Have a great night.
That's Laura Lippman, and Laura's latest novel is called Prom Mum. It's published by Faber and Faber. Natalie McMaster is a Canadian fiddle player and step dancer. Donal Leahy is an accomplished fiddle player who was once a member of the Leahy family folk group. Natalie McMaster and Donal Leahy are now husband and wife. They are in our Galway studio along with their daughter, Mary Frances Leahy, and a guitar player called Tim Eddy. They're going to start with some music, a track called The Chase. Whoa, it's right. I can feel the heat from the Galway studio across the country in Dublin. That was a track called The Chase from Donnell Leahy, his wife Natalie McMaster, their daughter Mary Frances Leahy, and the guitar player Tim Eddy. I'll go to you first on this one, Natalie. Tell me a little bit about that tune. Phenomenal energy behind it, it has to be said.
Well, thanks. We're trying to whip up a party here for you. We're in the studio here, and that track is actually one that we wrote a few years back, and it just translates really well, especially with two fiddles. I think hopefully you heard the harmony parts there.
We did.
Yeah, so it works well for this sort of thing.
And I note that you are a step dancer, as is your daughter, Mary Frances Leahy. Were you dancing as you played there? Will you be dancing at the gigs?
Not quite. I was very focused and well-behaved, sitting on my little chair, trying to make my fiddle sound as good as possible for you.
Well, you succeeded in that for sure. Let me go to Donnell. I think that is from your first album, Donnell, called One, in fact. But you and Natalie were married quite a while before the thought of making music professionally together, I think, came into play. Am I right in thinking that?
That's right. We kind of book our schedules a couple of years in advance now, a year and a half to a year in advance. And we got married, we were both kind of doing our own thing for a couple of years. And we always kind of knew that we'd be playing together at some point. But the careers just kept doing our thing. And then I think what really spurred it on was when we started having little ones, and we wanted to travel as a family, and I think that was the right time for us. So that's when we kind of joined forces.
Yeah, so it was easier for the both of you to travel with the entire family. And am I right in thinking that you are in fact in Ireland right now with all of the family, which is seven children? Is that right?
You're almost right. We're in Ireland right now with five of the seven. We left the two little ones at home. We have a 5-year-old and a 9-year-old, both girls, and just felt that it was best that they, for everybody, that they stayed home with grandma and grandpa and all their nieces and nephews, and allow us to kind of stay up late and run ragged.
Yeah. and what did you say the two youngest were, Donnell?
9 and 5.
9 and 5. So I suppose going up from that, Natalie, you're probably into the teenage years, and I don't need to know Mary Frances's age or anything like that, but I think the older members of the family, are they all playing music?
They are. Yep. It's pretty amazing. When they were little, I'd say 3 to 4 years old, Donnell and I, with our first, of course, Mary Frances, who's now 17, we thought, oh, you know what? We have to teach our kids the fiddle, just like Donnell's father taught him and just like my father taught me. And it's as important as eating your vegetables for us. So we got them going at about that age. And, you know, in the beginning, I suppose I had hopes and dreams of that they would, you know, always be playing music and be great musicians. Now that we've gone through some years of parenting, I realize the number one thing is that you help your kids find what they love to do and find what makes them happy, find them what makes them grow, you know, in their mind and their heart and their souls. And so, you know, music is great for the young ages, and as they grow up, they're going to have to choose it for themselves. We've got a couple who are very interested in continuing on with music, and the rest of them are just a bit too young yet to know what their life plan is. But it's been a wonderful asset for our family life so far.
Yeah, and the fact that you can all play together while out on tour must mean an awful lot to you. Maybe you could explain to me the piece that we just heard. Is it part of what we might call the Cape Breton style, which I think is the easiest label I can put on your style of fiddle playing, Natalie?
Well, for sure you can put that style, slap that label on me, because that's really what I play. I mean, I grew up there. It's in the core of everything I am. Even when I dabble in other styles or other tunes from different from different traditions, they all kind of come out sounding Cape Bretonized, if you will. But the tune that we played called The Chase, here's where the combination or the marriage kind of on the fiddles had to come. You know, when you listen to that Chase tune, it's not Cape Breton-y. It's not really my sort of thing. And it's not Donnell's either. It's where we meet as two individual styles and sounds. It's where we come together kind of in harmony. And so that tune, we both wrote it. We find what works well because our styles are so different. It works really well if we write tunes together at the same time. And we come up with something that's really the marriage of the two of us. If you were to take me now and spend, you know, a number of minutes just playing the Cape Breton stuff, it would sound different. And same, likewise, for Donnell, his style is so very different. So the chase is where we meet in the middle.
And then, Donnell, what is, if Natalie's is quite definitely the Cape Breton style, how would you describe your style of music and what does that bring to the marriage?
Yeah, I think what defines my style mostly was not listening to fiddle players when I was young. And it's because I grew up in an area in Canada where ice hockey was the way of the day. And my father played and my mother played piano. But I started when I was three, and until I was, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, I never really heard other fiddle players play. So I kind of developed my own thing. Listening to the radio, we had a friend who played accordion, and I'd listen to piano players play. And I just sort of got well established in what I was doing before I heard fiddle players. And when that time came, I remember when I was 9, I was given 4 records of awesome fiddle players, one being Sean Maguire from Ireland. And I was just so ready to listen and to hear and to learn. But I was sort of kind of already established for 6 years. So I think that's... My style's all over the place. I play Cape Breton stuff, tunes, and I dabble in some Irish stuff. I'd never call myself an Irish player or a Cape Breton player, but I love the music, and I play those tunes, and it comes out Leahy-eyed.
He's really his own thing. It's hard to say what he is. He's just kind of cool and himself.
Thank you, Natalie.
Yeah, it's good to hear that you feel that after how many years of marriage is it now?
20
years of marriage.
Almost 21.
And there you go. And you still fancy the guy sitting across the studio from you. That can't be that can't be a bad thing at all. I noticed it, as I was listening to the chase that we heard, I kind of got a touch of a French flavour off it as well. I don't know if that's a Quebecois thing or if there's a French-Canadian thing that's seeping in there as well.
You're very, very astute. Yes, I was heavily influenced by the French-Canadian culture of music, accordion music, but there was a French-Canadian fiddle player who I was quite fond of, Tijan Carignan, wicked player. In fact, I do a step dancing style that comes from the Quebec. Right. We call it French Canadian step dancing. And so I've been heavily influenced by Quebec. So to hear that in my music is good on you.
Well, there you go. So it's you that was doing the step dancing as we were listening in the midst of all of that. Let's go to a second piece, actually, if we could. Caramello. Now, that has an Italian sound to it. Am I going to hear a little bit of Latin in this, Natalie, or what am I going to get? This is from the most recent album, I think, is it?
It is. It is. Our new record is called Canvas, and this is one of my favorite tracks. And it's a tune that Donnell wrote. But during the pandemic, our daughter, who's now 17, she was 14 at the time when it started, and she had all these new hours to spend at home. And she ended up playing a lot of piano and fiddle and practicing a lot, and she got into Latin music, and particularly salsa. And so when Donnell, who wrote this jig, would sit down with her to play, she'd mess around with different Latin rhythms over top, and it created this new kind of flavor. Donnell loved it, and between the two of them, they just kind of, you know, practicing through the days and the weeks, it just kind of became its own little flavor. And it has this Latin overtone with the Celtic music, with Donnell's undescribable sound, and me in the background saying, put some Cape Breton in there.
Okay. So I was thinking it was some kind of ice cream flavour, but no, it is a musical flavour that we're going to get in Caramello. I want to go to a party in your house with all of the music that would be heard there, and I certainly want to see some of the gigs that I will tell people about after we listen to this final performance from you. Thanks so much for being with us this evening, and I leave you now to play the tune Caramello for us.
Thanks so much, Sean. Nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Caramello, the name of the piece. That's from the album Canvas, but performed live in our Galway studio this evening for us by Donnell Leahy, by Natalie McMaster, their daughter Mary Frances Leahy, and guitar player Tim Eddy. Natalie, Donnell and family are playing in St Paul's Church in Mullingar tomorrow, Wednesday the 9th, as part of this year's Flack Hole na Héireann. They'll then perform across the entire weekend at the TG Cahir Fla Village at the Fair Green Shopping Centre in Mullingar, and you can find out full details on flahiol.ie. And our thanks to our colleague John Doyle in Galway for sending that music up the line to us so brilliantly. You're listening to Monday Night's Arena.
Jason and the Argonauts, the classic story of an epic voyage that has been told and retold since the birth of Western civilization, now presented on the screen for the first time. The mightiest warriors the world of adventure has ever known, in search of the fabulous magic golden fleece. Here is the magnificent excitement of that legendary time when men like gods and gods like men lived and loved violently. Todd Armstrong and Nancy Kovac portray the classic lovers. Jason, the man who challenges the gods. Medea, who betrays a kingdom for love. One man defying a universe of mortal and immortal danger. Jason and the Argonauts. A search that became a legend.
Released in 1963, celebrating its 60th anniversary this year, Jason and the Argonauts was, believe it or not, a box office flop. Made for $3 million, it recouped $2.1 million in cinema sales. And yet the story of Jason's epic quest for the Golden Fleece has since become a cult classic, due in no small way to Ray Harryhausen's groundbreaking special effects. Undeniably of its time. I think that trailer shows that. It's worth noting that the film and those Ray Harryhausen effects have inspired some of the great modern cinema directors, including Steven Spielberg, Peter Jackson, James Cameron, George Lucas, Wes Anderson, to name but a few. Declan Burke has been re-watching Jason and the Argonauts for about the 15th time, he tells me, and he's here to talk to me about what makes that film so special. As you listen to that, I wondered, what year were we in when that film was made? 1963. Even by 1963 standards, that trailer suggests a very old-fashioned film.
Yeah, even when it came out, it was already a throwback. I mean, this is a film that was kind of an homage to the great kind of matinee movies of the 1930s. You know, it starts out with the sacking of a city and the profaning of a goddess's altar and doesn't quit. You know, it's one adventure after another after another. Not a very well plotted movie.
Basically, it's a guy who's told in a prophecy that he will be killed by the child that he's allowed to escape from the sacking of the city.
That child
being Jason.
That is Jason. And Pelias is the man who's told he's going to be killed by the one saddled man. So what does he do? He sends Jason off on effectively a suicide mission to the far end of the world, as it was then, to Colchis to retrieve the Golden Fleece.
So here we are talking about it as a cult classic. Huge box office flop at the time. Why was it such a flop at the time? Absence of stars, I think,
possibly,
might have been one of the reasons,
wasn't
it?
Because critically, actually, it got, you know, it wasn't raved about, but, you know, the critical reception was quite solid. But yeah, look, Todd Armstrong, this is the biggest movie of his career, and a lot of people out there are saying Todd Armstrong, who... you know, Nancy Kovacs, again, Honor Blackman plays Hera, the goddess.
She would have been the biggest star at the time,
she was, but this was even just before the Avengers took off, before Goldfinger, so even she wasn't a name star, she wasn't box office gold at the time.
Let's have a listen to Jason. This is the Todd Andrews character looking for help on his journey as he set off to try to find this golden fleece. Niall McGuinness plays the character of Zeus here. Honor Blackman, as you mentioned, plays the character of Hera, Queen of the Gods, and Todd Armstrong is Jason, interestingly dubbed over by another actor called Tim Turner. However, here he is speaking to the gods.
What is it you want? A ship? A crew?
No. Those I can find myself.
Oh. And what are you going to use in place of gold?
The hearts of men.
I am Hera, Queen of the Gods, and your protector on this voyage. But my Lord Zeus has decreed a limit to the number of times I may help you when you call upon me. Do not speak now. I know what you must ask of me. Does the Golden Fleece exist? And if so, where is it?
That's two questions.
And I shall help him with only one answer. Search in the land of Colchis.
Then it does exist. But Colchis, that's the end of the world. No Greek has ever sailed there.
Now that you've heard that, are you so sure that you will not need my help? Think carefully.
As if the trailer wasn't enough to show you how hammy the acting is. that little scene from Jason and the Argonauts certainly gives us pause for thought. But one of the things that I think is so important in this, and I played that scene from the gods, because as the gods go down to Earth to fix things up down there, they kind of, there's this kind of magic dissolve, and then they reappear up in the heavens in the world of the gods, as it were. So Harry, what's his name? Oh, he's gone out of me.
Ray Harryhausen.
The special effects were vital to this film, and they really were groundbreaking.
100%. And Ray Harryhausen, who was, he established a new form of animation. This was his favourite film, the effects that he created for this one. Now, his career started way back about 15 years previously and so forth, but this is where he really hit the ground running. Four brilliant sequences, one with Talos, the bronze giant, there's the winged harpies, there is the Hydra that Jason battles, and then the classic scene of the seven skeletons that are brought to life and sent
well,
to battle
Jason. Without getting bogged down in all of the technicalities of it, you might explain, I think if people have seen the film at all, they'll know that scene with the fighting the skeletons is what we see. And we see real life people fighting these stop animation skeletons. Just explain what Harryhausen did there.
Well, it's a thing called dynamation is what he, that was his phrase for it. And I'm actually going to read the notes and not pretend that I know this, Sean, because
it's... Don't be giving me the five paragraph version of it though.
He splits the background and the foreground and he inserts the models into the action that is happening before and behind the actual live action that has been shot. Like, it's a 7-minute sequence with the skeletons and so forth. That took 4 months in pre-production to put together frame by frame by frame. And when we look at it, it's incredibly fluid. It looks a bit rickety by our standards of special effects.
But if you think of what he had to do, essentially he shoots this scene with people acting down in the background and people acting in the foreground, and then he puts the stop animation into the middle ground of the shot.
Absolutely.
And he has people fighting these skeletons, so the placing of people must have been incredibly difficult.
Phenomenal. No such thing as green screen back then.
Yeah, and he didn't have a video player to kind of play back over it and see, did that work?
Yeah, look, I mean, Tom Hanks, he was presenting, or he was hosting an award in which Ray Harryhausen was being given a lifetime award. This is back in, well, not long before Harryhausen died. But he said, you know, basically you can keep your Casablanca and your, you know, such like... Jason and the Argonauts is the finest film ever made. Citizen Kane was it. Now, I think he might have been over-egging the pudding. Mm. But those sequences, they deserve to be spoken about in the same breath as Citizen Kane and, you know, Casablanca, for innovation, for cinematic intelligence, for the way he, you know, like he was, as you said, he was breaking new ground. And you recited the list of the great directors who have been inspired by him to this
day. And is he acknowledged by those directors as a major influence, Ray Harryhausen?
Just not acknowledged, but, you know, beloved for what he achieved. I mean, there's a brilliant, if anyone wants to Google it, there's a brilliant interview with John Landis, who was one of the, you know, great special effects innovators as well. They love him. They revere him. He gets all the credit that he deserved.
Yeah, there is an interview with Landis where he really is going through how those effects are all achieved, and it is well worth listening to. Outside of the special effects, do you want us to go and watch Jason and the Argonauts anyway?
I do, because there's a beautiful charm to it. Look, it was shot on location, so we get that genuine Greece, Italy, so forth. It is cheesy. All the dialogue, as you suggest, you know, it's as if it was printed up in block capitals and so forth. Hammy, cheesy, all the rest. It's a shot of pure cinema joy.
All right.
Yeah, I would say go watch it.
Declan Burke speaking to us about Jason and the Argonauts. First hit cinema screens on August the 7th, 1963, a full 60 years ago. And you can watch it in full online if you just put in Jason and the Argonauts full film up it'll come, and you can watch it free of charge. But that is our lot for this Monday evening. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Paula Shields and Amandine Pastor Devine research. Damien Chanel was on sound here in Dublin this evening, and tonight's programme produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night once again at 6:30. John Creedon is on the way.